Blog Talk Radio.
Like that, but some of us do. But I think you'll find the program is really looking around the center, that pulls us back to an understanding that our practices flow, our practices and our interpretations of Masonry involve our imagination, our history, our lived experience, and are influenced by our level of scholarship. Now, that's not to suggest that there's only one way that we absorb information. Far from it. There are different ways, but we know that each of those ways requires a different set of skills. For example, some people are more academic, that comes out as an insult. Some people are more intellectually inclined. Some people are more philosophically inclined or psychologically inclined. It simply means that they're able to accept other interpretations to their own thinking. A skeptic would be happy with that because a skeptic will be weighing all the considerations from different sides of the argument, and will sit somewhere in the middle. It could be like that. It could be like that. So I find the solace in the sitting in the middle. I'm devil's advocates do this. It drives me mental, you know. Just the Stoic will be operating on a different leverage. You know that something is what it is, and you just live with it. You just live with it. We have different ways of thinking. The Greeks helped us identify this, like they did. They helped us identify drama and comedy, and we've used that ever since. Now, I don't. You could go and ponder what that says about humanity or about the genius of Athens, and whether we're a product of determinism or free will. Masons would want to reflect on that, but not all. We learn in different ways. We learn by watching. We learn. If I was to suggest that our contemporary version of scholarship is the way, I would be, I think, ignoring the fact that that's not how the Druids learned. That's not how the Mesopotamians learned. Language becomes important to be able to convey ideas, and not just mouth to ear, but from one person to many, and it allows for a reflection. We look at it without the source being there with us to help explain it. We're left to follow the flow, follow the direction of the idea, and make some presumptions that the person is making a contribution. Ayn Rand might be you might have Ayn Rand's material on your bookshelf, but that does not mean that you're dystopian. It doesn't. It means that you've read that, you've studied it, you're curious about it. It's like reading some of the villains of our cultural villains, and realizing that the message has been so incredibly distorted by media or gossip that that we're satisfying some other craving. We need to somehow create monsters. We need to have a villain to fight him, because reason alone is not a satisfying. It doesn't satisfy that lust. To deal with the life as it is wonderful, I think, because it requires a presence and living in presence. I'm one of those practitioners that think enhancing that moment or that is not necessarily troubling. It's probably a smart thing to do. It's like when I go to the theater, I go to opera, the house lights dim before the performers come out. It's staging. There's music going on. I hear the orchestra tuning last minute. And then I hear everybody come together in preparation for the curtain opening. It's preparing me. It's preparing in stages. It prepares me just like waiting in line with my ticket. And then handing my coat in to the clerk, and then finding my seat with my partner. It's with my wife. It's lovely. It's staging. It's preparation. It's anticipation. We do that. Masonry allows us to do that. I like to think that the symbols on the wall are a part of it. Mm-hmm. And when I see the walk in the old lodge in lodge rooms, I get an idea about the presence, the foresight of the men who built it. If you try and experience the feel, you get a sense of the interpretation of masonry. Some is artistic and absolutely beautiful. And it's aged, and it's respect for history. Others are more contemporary. But that's not necessarily an act of construction. And you think, we only have to think over what Britain, what Europe was like after it had been savaged by world wars. And it was rebuilt. And people didn't build toward the future. They also built with a sense of their past, to capture the culture. And it's more important, and I'm more aware of it because I'm in a country that hasn't quite achieved that level of community awareness yet. We're communities all over the place. But we're getting there. We like our community, just like Masons like our community. We move forward with that sense of atmosphere, almost like it's a mnemonic. It helps trigger certain thoughts. I like the age. I like the stillness. The world around can be just noise, that madding crowd, eh? And sometimes in the middle of a large crowd, we can feel very, very alone. I don't know if you've ever experienced that and sat back and wondered at it all, being the observer. There's different levels of that happens, not just one mindset. It changes. It changes as the day changes, as what we face around us changes. But the Masonic Lodge, the Masonic Lodge can be that, a place where you center yourself, where you can collect your thoughts, where you can reflect on the sacred moment, sacred atmosphere that we create. You think we create. And then we can easily ask ourselves, is that real? Yeah, do. Go ahead. Ask yourself, is that real? Well, it is for me. It is. And it is. Is it spiritual? It is for me. I think I consider myself one of the fortunates, not a misfit, but the lighting and the sound and the procedures, the ceremony, even if somebody has walked through with just a light whiff of incense, that it just creates that it's attacking the senses, it's opening the senses. And for me, I like to think that that's triggering imagination. Because I think the question that I need is to ask is about receiving this this awareness. It's the light. We seek it to receive it. Are we ready for it? Are we willing to do what it takes? Well, who's going to ask such a silly question? Would a practical man ask such a silly question? Well, I think a practical man might go through his day and believe that somehow that enlightenment is going to happen, or that his definition of enlightenment has more to do with the initiation. That is enlightening, to be redefined for, you admit, for a lot of men, to be redefined on an elevated level, instead of somebody saying, ah, he's a loser, ah, he's dishonest, ah, he's a shyster, ah, he's mean. You know, is an eye-opener. Here I am faced with something that is alien, it's new, it's unfamiliar. And yet, it's not utopia around me. Everybody's not smiling and giggling and high-fiving. It's not just oozing enthusiasm. And in fact, I wish the enthusiasts would sit down for just a second and, you know, instead of trying to sell the product, you get tired of that. You're selling an idea that needs to be exposed from within. It needs to be... It's like you're trying to eat my dinner for me. Well, don't be digesting it for me. I'm quite capable of doing that. As a matter of fact, you can't really eat my dinner. You can't do my work for me. I have to do that. The opportunity, it doesn't. If we're just locked in a sense of the opportunity, we're doing nothing. We're doing really. You have great. I don't know. when I was a little boy, it was said I had great opportunity. I had great potential. Potential. You have that energy field that also tells you and teaches us that it's not enough. Potential is not enough. Action. That's where we savor the benefits, where we begin to find that change, that metamorphosis, if you will. The craft is not necessarily pretty. It's the search of the truth. So what do we do when we experience things that aren't pretty, that aren't gleeful, aren't easy, that there's challenges where you just want to walk away from it all, where you feel discouraged, where it gets real? Well, the idea is to prevail. We prevail or not. Work through and battle through the challenge, to use a metaphor, or not. Well, you want a little help or reinforcement of that. You could reach over and grab your copy of the Iliad and read through it until you again are reminded that this is a metaphor. Mm-hmm. And the journeys are lessons. And not everybody finished the journey, did they? Some people with great potential self-destruct, and yet, this is just a little sidebar. There's people that you may underestimate, who think you may consider they have no possibility of achieving, and yet they do. Some people waste their abilities, and other people work very hard with everything that they have to achieve. And I like those people. I like those people more than the desultory smugness of people that think that it's beneath them. The struggle is beneath them. The dominance, that's an illusion, like the reality of control. The sense of control, that's an illusion. Oh, how dare I? But there you go. It's not for everybody to think at that level. The fear and carnage, that's something else. That's control is one thing, fear is another. Intimidation is another. Do we have the values entrenched within us to help us understand and accept or embrace this is progress? Everything we do, whether it's a so-called success or a so-called failure, is an opportunity for us to take in the information and learn and progress. And in a very simple way, it's the foundation of the scientific model, isn't it? Observe. And try and make the best explanation for what you see, knowing that if we're fortunate, what we know will continue to expand until we are reevaluating earlier assumptions. We're doing that right now. We're doing that right now. So when you call me on the phone, there's a little my message. And ask you to help me understand this lurch forward. An infinite universe, you see, I don't understand. So it doesn't mean you sit in a state of what word would you use? Indifference to the world because we can't understand it. No, we go about our business. We continue to with a mindset questioning, but we go about our business the best way that we can. If we are unpleasant, if we feel, and I saw this example not too long ago, exercising their discomfort with me. And I noticed that in order to do it, most men do this, they display an ugly part of their character. They feel that if they become ugly, like become loud or angry or menacing or insulting, that somehow is going to influence and better my condition. Yeah, really. But they do it as if they have license to. Somebody has not done something that's not within my favor or my expectations. So I'll just exhibit a little bit of the ugliness of my character, and that'll do it. That'll teach them. Yeah, right. Doesn't work, does it? You're in control, are you? Mm-hmm. We know the things that control. Masonry teaches us that too. But we're taught a lot of things. I think we can admit, we can agree. We're taught a lot of things in an ideal state. The descriptions are idealisms. And we don't live in ideals. We live in reality. And that's lumpy. And every day we may wake up. The first thing on my mind isn't, oh, my goodness, there's reality. No. I'm a creature that has some habits and sentiments and likes and dislikes and tastes, all that, just like you. And I don't wake up at a certain time and think, there, I'm going to do the best job I can of getting through this day. I guess after I was, no, I never had that, notion. When I have the chance to sit back with you in Lodge and my thoughts are triggered by something that you've said, something that you've done, not your complaining and your silliness. No, you don't. You're just embarrassing yourself. But when I hear a story, when I hear a report of something, some discovery, somebody that's prevailed, that inspires me. It has meaning. And in a way, I suppose my pundits and critics could say, oh, you're far too old for that, or you're far too positioned for that, or you're far too educated for that. Not so. No, I checked. There's no timeline on the discovery of enlightenment or awareness. And, you know, it doesn't, the book, the work, I checked. The rules don't really tell us that you're going to go from nothing to everything. It doesn't say that. We're going to be stuck in the mud and thoughtless one day and aware and beautiful the next day. No. Doesn't it make more sense that this will be a practical, you know, gradual kind of a learning curve? Challenge with your imagination. See yourself first. Can you see yourself? But I'm suggesting you do. See yourself in that position of being a better person along the path, of being more and more in tune with what's going on, able to listen more than we're preaching. Oh, my Lord. The unpleasantness of a man proselytizing and being loud and aggressive about it, thinking that that validates what he's doing. You've been there. You've seen it all. It's you realize his view. If you think about it, you'll see his thinking about the world around him. You'll see that. Now, if that's your version of it, so be it. Then why be a Mason? I guess this is the question. Why attempt it? I attempt it. Today, we have it's like going to a concert where I'm enjoying the buzz as much as the audience. You know, yeah, it's like it's an event. It's something interesting. And of course, we want it. If it wasn't interesting, I wouldn't do it, and I don't think you'd be pulling up a chair. The commentary today is Enlightened Men Relate. The music, oh, Bill Evans, Kenny Durham, Coleman Hawkins, Miles Davis, yeah, you know. And a poet badly maligned, which I like to toy with, the badly maligned fellow, Gordon, Lord Byron's work. Yeah, it's a charming poem. And we'll talk a little bit about the importance of poetry. Huh? All of that in the next hour. Thanks. Let's get on with things, eh? Instead of just sitting around here chatting. Let's see if my computer isn't frozen here. There we go. It may not be frozen, but it ought to be. Oh my goodness. Yeah. There we go. A little tune here. Miles Davis. Remember the big fin cars of 1963? That's when that album came up. Enlightened Men Relate. Here I go. Only enlightened men should apply. There are times I truly think that ought to be nailed on doors of Masonic lodges. So much time is wasted trying to rehabilitate or reconfigure men who aren't interested. They are who they are. We know their shortcomings. We see ours, but we go through a pantomime, neither saying out loud fearing a loss of a relationship. We'll tolerate that because we feel a responsibility to make that sacrifice in order to have some level of cohesiveness. Where did that come from? It might seem idealistic to wonder about the possibilities if all men in our lodges were enlightened, like-minded, and capable. Imagine. We've all heard the language used, perfection, excellence, and I want to offer some support. They are concepts that need to be operationalized through our individual talents and abilities. The emphasis here is about relating to them as masons. I don't wonder this way of conceptualizing the relationship with masonry is lost to men who aren't familiar with the material. Of course not. They're going to be making their decisions based on values that they pulled from the only source they have, their lived experience, profane. That is the nature of our culture. There is always an uncomfortable relationship between the status quo and innovation. Newness has to be tried and tested, and at first glance, it is unpopular with the majority. History reminds us of this. Copernicus, Galileo, Picasso, Helen of Troy. Did she even really exist? We vilify what we don't understand. Ah, the effect of the agora. Oh, lovely. Thank you. Thank you to Athens again. No, at the heart of masonry is a question. Is it possible to remake dogma into awareness? Can a man actually change for the better? Can I actually change? Can you? And can a man be influenced for the better with values he does not understand and hasn't assimilated? Can a man be enlightened who can't relate to that concept? Probably. Obviously, the answer is no. Masonry gives us the capacity to justify the free radicals who wander off what seems like an important path to understanding. But there you have it. As we like to remind, masonry is not for everyone. But for those who have the ability and the willingness, it is amazing. It is amazing. We're fortunate. So fortunate. If you were at the Village Vanguard, New York City, in 1961, who would have heard Bill Evans doing the first take on his Alice in Wonderland album. Yeah. 1961. Crew cuts. Bobby Sox. Poetry. I'm going to talk to you about it a little bit. No, I'm not trying to sway your opinion about your own level of insight. No, you do that yourself. You know, I know that I'm a believer that we necessarily allow our egos to isolate us from experience. That's why masonry, you know, you're not going to go too far into discussions about masonry without just the little throwaway. You need to control do more than the consciousness, the awareness is awareness of ego. Oh, it gives us something to work with there, doesn't it? And how do we expand on that? How do we explore that for ourselves? here's my limited version of that. It's a poem. Poetry, it's like music. It does something to us. It's like mathematics. It does something to our thinking. It's like geometry. It's like nature. I don't know if it is all healing or correctness. Poetry was once, I'm reading this from the a post called the Biocardia, Poetry and Its Modern Significance. We change, but we're the same, yeah? Poetry was once one of the most significant literary mediums in popular culture. Today, it is negated from public discourse and communication, dismissed as pompous, presumptive, and lacking in use in the modern digital age. It's been argued that there is a striking absence of poetry from the public dialogues of our day. We're alerted to the fact that a century ago, our newspapers commonly ran poems in their pages. Today, one rarely sees a poem in the newspaper, which evidences the decline in poetry's popularity. In contrast, in the 19th century, the most eccentric feature of the entire culture was that it was simply mad for poetry, signifying a distinctive shift, prioritization of the form of modern society. Today, poetry has lost its grip on culture. Here, this culture, no longer a matter of, here, not Turkey and not Persia, no. No longer a matter of public importance, it has receded to the background of literature. One factor in poetry's downfall is the decline of print culture. As more convenient modes of communication have arisen with the growth of digital culture, reading has ultimately been replaced by more informative and entertaining forms. It is not necessarily that the production of literature is declining, but rather that its position in the culture has changed significantly over the past few decades. We can attend to the fact that at the current moment, writing is beginning to seem old-fashioned. Poetry has lost its public role, a duty it held for centuries and is now the exclusive venture of a small, isolated group of individuals. For many critics, then, poetry has become reduced to an exclusive form of art that fails to connect to the masses. It would be a natural assumption that poetry's decline has thereby reduced its significance. It is certainly accurate to attest that poetry no longer possesses the public role it once held, and that poetry is not as widely read or as highly commended as it once was. However, we seek to destabilize claims of poetry's insignificance as a result of these facts, with an argument that despite its decline, poetry still possesses significant social power. It will consider poets' and critics' views of the significance of poetry as an effective medium of articulation and connection, as well as drawing attention to the importance of poetry in times of anxiety and turmoil and hardship. The poet's engagement with world events often steps outside objective political fact, articulating for readers the inexpressible emotions and reactions that people could not put themselves into words. It's for this reason people sought to console themselves with poetry in an almost unprecedented way, especially after major threats. We'll come back one day, huh? Remember, W.H. Auden's September 1, 1939. the poet today. Yeah. The poet today, when we two parted, by a brother, George Gordon Byron, the 6th Baron, born on the same day as my wife, January 22nd, but in a different year. He was born in 1788. When he died in Greece in 1824, wasn't very old. He was the son of a fairly profligate captain, John Mad Jack Byron, and his second wife, Catherine Gordon. She was a Scots heiress. And after her husband had squandered most of her fortune, Mrs. Byron took her infant son to Aberdeen, Scotland, where they lived in lodgings on a meager income. The captain died in France in 1791. Oh, he wasn't born perfect, no. But he had a mother, a strong mother, a proud woman. She took him to England. He fell in love with the ghostly halls and the spacious ruins of Newstead Abbey. He was influenced. Perceptive little guy. Now, when you read about Byron, we'll read about his critics, the work of his critics. We'll read about the emphasis on the salacious lifestyle, you know, anything that could be sensationalized. I can only explain that this brother had so much more going for him than that. He's known as part of the Romantic movement. And that simply refers to an emphasis on emotion. The interest is because it hadn't been done before. And now look at this. And unfortunately, many people take romantic poet to mean a man perpetually besotted, star-crossed must this poet be to be so outcome with romance. The movement placed great emphasis on emotion. Nobody ever said which, let alone that it was to be romantic or, for that matter, positive in any way. With When We Two Parted, the poem we're going to get into today, Byron gives us a glimpse of biting anger fueled by jealousy. Oh, dear, a little too real. But much like his friend, the fellow that died very, very young, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Lord Byron had a rather cavalier attitude toward loyalty and romance. The historic record talks about him, mocks him for a lot of reasons. Tell me, how does this poem, When We Two Parted, reflect on the man? It recalls the end of a previous relationship that the narrator still feels deeply about. Do any of you know about bittersweetness? In silence and tears, half broken hearted, to sever for years, pale grew thy cheek and cold, colder thy kiss. Truly that hour foretold sorrow to this. The dew of the morning sank chill on my brow. It felt like the warning of what I feel now. Thy vows are all broken. And light is thy fame. I hear thy name spoken and share in its shame. They name thee before me and kneel in my ear, a shudder come o'er me. What went thou so dear? They knew not I knew thee. Who knew thee too well? Long, long shall I rue thee too deeply to tell. In secret we met, in silence I grieve, that thy heart could forget, thy spirit deceive. If I should meet thee after long years, how should I greet thee? With silence and tears? Man reflects back on an ill-fated relationship. Did you learn from it? Let's see. Yeah. Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I hope that is the fanfare that you need to take us to our part of history. It's the History Corner. Yay! We're going to talk a little bit about French lodges in the 1770s. We're going to mention a Rousseauian rhetoric, okay? Remember, just very quickly, Jean-Jacques Rousseau became quite famous for reconceiving the social contract as a compact between the individual and a collective general will aimed at the common good and reflected in the laws of an ideal state and for maintaining that existing society rests on a false contract, social contract that perpetuates inequality. So look around. Does he have a point? It's not right or wrong. Does he have a point? He's, as he said, man is born free and he is everywhere in chains. He stated that people could only experience true freedom if they lived in a civil society that ensured the rights and well-being of its citizens. And I would add, all citizens. We don't have that here yet. Yeah. In the late 1770s, Rousseauian, that rhetoric, that idea, could become quite heated, and it did. An orator in Grenoble in 1779 put it this way, being more philosophy, than those who tediously parade and sterilely seek to display the sublime maxims of the philosophies. The Masons search modestly to put them into practice. In ancient times, being a citizen was an important and noble matter, sufficient to satisfy all the desires of ambition. But in our modern institutions, where the form of government is such that the the majority of subjects must stay in the place assigned to them by nature. How is it possible to contribute to the common good? So we're talking about social stratification. Ah, okay, we're 13th, 14th century royalty, and or you're born to serfdom, and okay, it's not my fault. You'll stay there, and I'll treat you with the same dignity you deserve in order to build my own status. The orator finds the answer in, quote, feelings proud and republican, and contrasts them with the pride and arrogance displayed by cabals, factions, political assassinations, civil wars, by prohibitions that the love of one's country as if it were a revolt. An atmosphere of crisis is invoked, brought about by moral decay, by hereditary hatreds, jealousy, avarice, and cupidity. Predictably, the answer to this impasse lies in the Masonic temple, where morality and philosophy united seek to flourish, where in effect one can leave society, which is equated with the collision of interest and rivalry, both of which pose constant threats, even to Masonic idealism. Remember, where morality and philosophy united seek to flourish, where in effect one can leave society, which is equated with the collision of and rivalry, both of which pose constant threats even to Masonic idealism, the collision of interests. Eh? Like so many Masonic orations, this one was never published. We do not know why. What is clear is that into the simple temple of Grenoble, men have brought their growing impatience with contemporary social and political institutions. Enough? You have the sense? We had the awareness, all of us. It's like when we are when we're speaking about or reading about or studying a particular period and an awareness of government, but certainly not to suggest that the effect was uniform. Take a look around the real world. Some people are keenly attuned. Some people are zealous. Others find that there's nothing but impatience with it. Still others find that the problem with life is thinking too much, really. And here, Masonry comes along encouraging us to be aware, to be well-informed, to qualify our opinions. But for each one of us, we approach that in our own different way, our own unique way. And if we take this out of our hip pocket, that people believe what they want to believe, confirmation bias, how do we work with these new ideas, this new awareness? Well, we do when we understand confirmation bias. Is that enough? We are, after all, I guess, thinking about, I don't know if it's old school or to say it's old school is to suggest that these ideas don't have significance in our contemporary culture. And I would not. That's a fallacy. It's like what we read about poetry. It's lost its favor, but it's lost its significance. Obviously, I don't think it has. And yes, I know that the majority of people. Do I know it for a fact or do I know it as an impression? I know it as an impression because very few people around me in my day seemed, of course, I don't interview and talk to each and every one of them, but they don't seem to be reacting as if history is still significant, as if our past is significant because our past is diverse. We're no longer being born, living, and dying in the same small community. We have access to transportation, and we are little explorers, and we go and see. And we seek now opportunity for a better life. And who could blame anybody for doing that? Who? Comes and goes. Well, I see that it's time to go again. We finished as much as we could. Masonry might be a series of archetypes. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's all. Certainly not. Especially if we're talking about consciousness. That's a discussion. And at the end of the day, are we thinking that when philosophers are in the room, when philosophers are dealing with these subjects, that there's agreement? No. You've heard if there's three Masons in a discussion, opinion. Yes, and many more. That's the point. And you go away with your particular interpretations and translations of the world around, and I do too. And is the one better than the other? Maybe over a glass of port 100 years from now, somebody will discuss that and tell us. Eh? Somebody will explain the best part of that. Maybe we do represent the archetype. Maybe Hiram does, the archetype of inner truth. But the truth is unconscious and inexpressible. And we can maintain it by, you know, being, in a way, being passive to it. We all carry within us a dim sense of who we are, of a genuine self, never seen by other people. And impossible to explain. But when we throw ourselves into competition or careers or responsibilities without working at the same time to increase self-knowledge, often discover at some point that we've lost the sense of who we are, what we once wanted in life. I look forward to being with you again. Your help is unquestionable and so valuable. I hope you'll go about your business, committing acts of random Masonic kindness, defying the rules, you know, extending kindness and understanding to people that, quote, don't deserve it. Oh, my goodness, acceptance, insight. We wouldn't want that to break out too much. Come back. I hope to see you in a week's time. And if you happen to be a recipient of one of my acts of Masonic kindness, well, good. Especially if you don't know it's coming from me. It's been an occasion again. Thank you for tuning in. Little Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster for you. Bye.